Welcome back to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance. We are broadcasting live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel has the expertise to get you operating faster with forklifts and pallet racking in stock. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Now joining us, he is the voice of the Canucks here on Sportsnet 650. It's our guy, Brendan Batchelor. Batch, how's it going, man?
It's going well. How are you guys?
We're doing great. So just another day on the Canucks roller coaster last night and another improbable comeback, tying goal, and then actually a win in the shootout. What stood out to you the most? What's your number one takeaway from that performance and the win last night?
Quinn Hughes, I think.
Yeah.
And you know, you could say that about most Canuck games this year, but man, does this guy just continue to do it all and do as much as he can. And what was it, a career high for minutes for him last night? Mm-hmm. I think something crazy like that. So, you know, the level he's taking his game to try to will this team across the finish line into the playoffs is something like we've never seen in Vancouver from a player on the Canucks, I would argue. And I know Daniel and Henrik Sedin hit very high highs in their careers, and Pavel Bure was a tremendous player too. But in terms of a number one defenseman who can generate offense and do so much in terms of driving play, you know, it's pretty special to watch. And regardless of what happens the next 11 games, and whether this team find a way to climb back into this race and get into the postseason or not, seeing Quinn Hughes elevate has been a whole lot of fun, and I'm sure it will continue to be down the stretch here.
Yeah, I can't even really think, like, I'm trying to even think of league-wide examples, you know, and it's like Erik Karlsson maybe for a few years with the Senators.
I think not, it's obviously a different position, but I think the closest Canucks comparison is like the first Luongo season, where you're thinking about the flaws around the player and the superhuman effort to get them to the playoffs. Like, that's the one that stands out to me most. It's impossible to actually do an A-to-A comparison because he's a goalie, but if we're just talking like superhuman effort from a star player,
yeah,
that's the one that stands out to me the most.
Well, and Batch, we were talking about it a little bit that, like, sometimes when Quinn Hughes is maybe better supported, the lineup's a little more whole, you know, he can kind of make the game look easy. And one thing we were talking about was right now it doesn't look easy, and that almost lets you appreciate the effort of the magnitude of what he's accomplishing more.
Yeah, I mean, he's going supernova right now, but it's because he has to. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, you would like it to be a situation where you don't need Quinn Hughes to play 31 minutes a night. And you don't need him to be your main offensive driver. But with the injuries they've got right now, with some of the stuff they've gone through this year, look at what's around him. And he kind of does have to be that guy. And so, you know, it's not a sustainable long-term plan for success. It might not even be a sustainable short-term plan for success. I guess we'll see what happens, you know, the rest of the way here in the regular season. But, you know, this is what this team needs from him right now in order to have a chance. And he is stepping up and delivering in a tremendous way. And as I said, it's a lot of fun to watch. But at the same time, it would be a lot more fun to watch a team that supported him well enough that he doesn't have to do this. But that said, you know, there's lots of things that have gone wrong this year. They're, you know, riddled by injuries right now with Hedl and Pettersson and Hoglander all out of the lineup and unavailable, at least for the moment. And so if Quinn Hughes can be that guy for this team, then it's, you know, a pretty cool break glass in case of emergency situation to have. Although you don't want to have it all the time, and you want to do a better job of giving him a better chance to have success, you know, with his teammates, rather than having to try and do a lot of it on his own.
You don't want to be in a perpetual state of emergency where it's required night after night after night. But, you know, the other striking thing to me about Quinn Hughes this season is that he's the captain of the team as well, right? So it's not just his on-ice contributions, which are immense. It's what he has to do off the ice and in the dressing room as well. And I think you look at last night's game, you know, Drance and I were talking yesterday about how hard to kill this team is. Every time it feels like they're done, they find a way to get back in it, whether you're talking about the playoff race or an individual game. We saw that on display last night. It reminds me a little bit of like a wrestler taking near falls in a match or something, right? Where you're like, oh, they're not going to kick out of this one. And then somehow they do. But I think he deserves a lot of credit for that, too. The resilience and this the state of being hard to kill that this team shows, like a lot of that you got to credit to Hughes as the captain, too.
Well, absolutely, because, you know, he's always involved when they're in those 6-on-5 situations.
Yeah.
And, you know, he has really turned into a tremendous young leader in this league. And, you know, you talk about he's the captain this year. He's elevating his game. Think about all of the BS that he's had to deal with as the captain of this team, right? Like, if I'm not mistaken, there's been lots of reporting that he was heavily involved in trying to make things work with Miller and Pettersson and, you know, has been in the midst of a lot of these issues, trying to help, trying to fix things, trying to work both on and off the ice to get this team into a best case scenario. And, you know, I definitely felt it when he was on the ESPN broadcast last night after the game and talked about how it's been a super long year. I can't remember exactly what he said, but like the weight with which he said the words, this has been a long year, really sort of resonated with me that like, man, he's really felt every step of the way this year and how much of a challenge it's been. And yet through all of that, through the injuries he's missed, through the fact that he's probably not at 100% right now as well, what he continues to do is special and pretty cool. And oftentimes you see, we talk about teams taking on the identity of their coaches. They're going to take on the identity of their leaders too. And so if Quinn Hughes has a never say die, hard to kill mentality, then that's going to be reflected in the way the team plays in some of those moments as well.
You know, because like we've had so much to chew on that it feels like Miller plays the Canucks again and repeats sort of the line that things with Pettersson were overblown. Like we haven't had a chance to talk about it.
No.
You know, we honestly haven't gotten into it at all. So I might as well use this opening batch for us to discuss it together. What did you make of sort of the game between Miller and the Canucks, the reunion of sorts in Manhattan this past weekend, and some of what Miller told the assembled press, including Sportsnet's Ian McIntyre pregame?
Yeah, I mean, I don't read too much into what JT says about the situation, because this is a guy now that wants to move on from all of that, right? So, you know, I wouldn't expect him to say something inflammatory to, you know, create a bigger narrative about it. I'm sure from his perspective, as he said, a change was needed. It seems like everybody believes a change was needed. Now he's got that change. So why would you want to go and, you know, dig up past issues and drag them through the mud again, right? So, you know, from JT's sort of analysis of the situation, you know, maybe there is a chance it's overblown. None of us were in the room. None of us were behind the scenes. So we don't really know. But it was clear that it was enough of an issue that something had to change, and it did change. In terms of the game, the Canucks were incredibly unfortunate to not have success. And I was taken aback by just how dreadful the New York Rangers were for a team that's in the thick of a playoff race. They were almost as bad as the Chicago Blackhawks were in that 6-2 game. And with the guys they have on that roster, I think that's very startling. And so from a game perspective, the Canucks were horribly unlucky to not win that game based on, you know, less so how good the Canucks were, although I thought they played a good game, but more so how bad the Rangers were. And, you know, we'll do this all again with the JT Miller conversation the first time he comes back to Vancouver next season. And, you know, we'll talk about all these things, and it'll be put within the context of how the Canucks are doing when that team comes, because if the Rangers come to town and the Canucks are struggling, then it'll be a lot of what if they could have worked it out with JT Miller, what if this, what if that. Conversely, if management goes out, has a good offseason, and the Canucks come back stronger next year, then, you know, you'll kind of be looking back on that as an ex that's won the breakup and kind of can be like, you know, hold your shoulders a little higher in seeing that. But, you know, I thought Ian McIntyre, he was on our station couple days ago, I think, and was asked about it. And he said, I was felt really excited to get to chat with JT. I don't think he was as excited to talk to me. And that doesn't surprise me that JT would want none of the conversation around what happened with him in Vancouver and what happened with him in Pedersen and would just want to move on. And I thought his comments reflected that to a certain extent.
Yeah, I'm shocked that JT wasn't excited to see a Vancouver media member so striding down the hallway at MSG to chat with him. Would have thought he would have loved that. So the Canucks get the big win last night. And obviously, a big part of the story is the absence of Elias Pettersson and Nils Höglander, you know, two-thirds of what had been their top line and playing pretty well going into that game. And now we don't know exactly how long the absence will be, but at least these next three games on the road trip. And, you know, in their absence, look, Pugh Suter stepped up and played a ton of minutes and was really effective. They cobbled it together elsewhere in the lineup. But there's always that concern that, hey, you might be able to get kind of that one-off performance when you're testing your depth so much, but sustaining it for any of length of time might be a little difficult. How concerned are you about that element and that dynamic playing out here over the final few games of this road trip?
Yeah, well, I am concerned about it. Although that said, let's be perfectly frank and look at the seasons that Nils Höglander and Elias Pettersson have had. And it's not like you're losing 100 point peak Pettersson, although he was trending in the right direction. And it's not like you're losing 24 even strength goal Nils Höglander. So yeah, they're going to miss those guys certainly, but this is a team that even with those guys in the lineup was going to need depth scoring, was going to need guys to step up into roles that maybe they wouldn't be perfectly cast in or play bigger minutes or play in more important situations. So I don't know if a lot has changed in that regard. Obviously, you know, Pugh Suter goes from being your 3C to your 2C to your 1C with Hedl and Pettersson now out of the lineup. So that's a lot to ask from him. And, you know, ultimately he had a good night last night, but you're right. I think one of the biggest things that distinguishes top players in the league from good players in the league is consistency and their ability to do it night in and night out. You know, any player in the league can be the best player on the ice for one night, right? But how do you do it for two nights, for three nights, for four nights, for the majority of the nights throughout the season? So, you know, I don't know if the conversation changes that much in saying that this has to be a team effort. This has to be everybody pulling on the rope. This has to be depth scoring. This has to be commitment to defense. It has to be strong goaltending. It has to be good special teams. It was going to have to be all of those things anyways without Pettersson and Höglander in the lineup. And now I think that just gets amplified a little bit more. So, you know, ultimately we'll see what happens the rest of this trip. You know, if they can pick up two out of the next three in terms of wins, then you set yourself up in an okay scenario coming home within the context of the Western Conference playoff picture. I think that's probably what you know, a baseline of what you need to get out of these three games, which is a tough ask. But, you know, we saw that, you know, when they commit to playing their game and when they can get some depth scoring, and most importantly, when they can limit their mistakes without the puck, it gives them a chance to win on a nightly basis. And these last two games where, you know, they were the better team against the Rangers, but some of those mistakes really cost them. And then even last night, it goes back and forth in the third period and they need the late tying goal to salvage something from the game and go on to win it. That's what concerns me a little bit more right now is, you know, some of those plays in their own zone where guys are getting left wide open or players are missing assignments. That is the place where there's the least margin for error right now. And if they can clean up their defensive game and get back to being the team that they've been for most of this second half of the season in terms of, you know, an elite penalty killing team, an elite defensive team, then that gives them the platform to try and win games. And then after that, you hope you get some scoring from throughout your lineup without some of your top offensive players.
So the betting markets kind of have the Canucks at, you know, 4-1 to make the playoffs. The Athletic model has them at 3-1 to make the playoffs here, Batch. The truth is that the odds are high, and yet we know how quickly things can change if the Canucks can keep winning, right? And if one of Calgary, well, I guess both of Calgary and St. Louis wobble a bit here. How are you thinking about the Canucks perch in the standings and what the next couple weeks are going to be like to experience and call.
Yeah, well, it's hard to think ahead because you have to live in the moment so much with it because, mm-hmm. let's be honest, a Blues win tonight over Montreal coupled with a Canucks loss to the Islanders tomorrow almost ends the conversation. Conversely, a Blues loss tonight to Montreal and a Canucks win over the Islanders tomorrow puts Vancouver right back in the thick of this race. So, you know, our old friend Jason Botchford used to always say life moves fast. I think that really applies to this playoff race where every day the stakes of every game at this point are so high that you could have a 24-hour period where suddenly you're right back in the race, or you could have a 24-hour period where suddenly you're out of it. And I think that's what we saw over the weekend, or it felt that way anyway, when the Canucks lost to the Rangers, and then on Saturday and Sunday, every result went against them on the Outer Town scoreboard. You know, that can happen to you, and then you feel like you're out of it, but then you get a win, and you feel like you're right back in the mix, and then maybe St. Louis loses tonight, and who knows? So it's hard to really project longer term on what this race looks like, because once you get into April, you know, you have no idea how much meaning those games could have, right? Like, if the Canucks lose three of their next four, those games in the second week of April aren't going to mean a lot. Conversely, if the Canucks win three of their next four, they extend the opportunity to play these meaningful games that matter. And if they get help on the Outer Town scoreboard, that's great as well. I do think St. Louis is probably due for a wobble just because the pace they've been on with the number of games they've been winning feels unsustainable the rest of the way for a team that, you know, for the most part this season hasn't shown that they're capable of playing at that level where they win 8 out of 10 games routinely. So, you know, if you can get hot in the Canucks, if you can be a team that rattles off, you know, 7 wins in the last 11 is kind of where it feels like that bar is being set right now, then because all the other teams around you are imperfect as well and have their flaws, that feels like it might be enough to get you there. But ultimately, you don't know until the games are played. And with every day that passes and every game that passes, it really is a roller coaster ride, because it felt like, you know, going into the game last night against New Jersey and in the third period when they're trailing late, you're sitting there thinking, if they don't win this game, if they don't find a way to tie it, then you can, you know, maybe not mathematically kiss their playoff hopes goodbye, but theoretically, yeah, it felt like that. Then you get the tying goal, you win it in the shootout, and suddenly you're looking ahead tonight and say Montreal beats St. Louis, and you're right back in the thick of this race and right back in the middle of the pack. So, that's kind of how I think of it is, you know, like Jim Benning used to say, we take things day by day. And I think that's how you have to take a playoff race like this, because things can change so drastically in the space of, you know, a day or two that it's hard to project longer term what things might look like. But, you know, in saying that, it's up to the Canucks to take care of their own business. So you've got a game tomorrow. You've got to focus everything you have on winning that game. And if you win that game and you get some results on the Outer Town scoreboard, then maybe things look better. But every loss at this point in the season is a serious dent to their playoff hopes. And so every game needs to feel like game 7 with 11 games left. And that's not an ideal situation to be in, but it's the spot they find themselves at this point of the year.
Yeah, we live in today's world, I think, another part of that one, which always left me scratching my head. How outraged are you about the Lekkomäki stick twirl before his shootout attempt, Patch?
Oh, it was awesome. Are you kidding?
Yeah. To me, it almost looked like it was like a free throw routine from a basketball player or something. You know what I mean? It's like, this is just what I do when I'm going to shoot. It was like almost not even conscious from him, it looked like to me.
Are people actually outraged about it?
I don't know.
Is that a real thing? Or is it the Vancouver media creating things?
No, I haven't seen anyone in the media. I sometimes with the hockey code, I can't even tell if it's tongue in cheek or people are actually fired up about it. You know what I mean? Like, the line is so blurred.
Isn't it just that Demko said we'll have to talk to him about that?
Yeah, I think that's it.
Yeah, I mean, who knows if he was
kidding. Was probably just joking, yeah. Anyways, right? So yeah, but it looked pretty awesome. But it was a great shoot.
Well, Markstrom was pretty mad.
Yeah, well, but Jacob Markstrom is one of the fieriest competitors I've seen and covered in this league. So I think regardless of who put that goal in or how it went in, it was a game where his team had a lead in the final minute where he was playing his former team. That stick had no chance if the Canucks were winning that game anyway. And And just a quick thing on Lekkerimäki, it shows a little bit of swagger, and I like that, because that's something that when this team has been good, and when they were good last year, they had that swagger, they had that vibe around them, and that's been missing for most of this year. So if a guy with a bit of youthful exuberance can come in and provide some offense and bring some swagger and bring that element back to the team, then that's only a good thing.
No doubt. Batch, always appreciate the time, man. Thanks for doing this.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
That is Brendan Batchelor. He is the voice of the Canucks here on Sportsnet 650, weighing in on the Canucks win from last night. And yeah, that point about the swagger and the energy from Lekkerimäki, he definitely, even if there's times where he's making mistakes, it never feels like he's nervous out there necessarily to me. And I think that means a lot when you're a young player. And he hasn't been shy about looking for his offense or trying to make plays either, right? Now he's up to 3 goals. You're starting to see, I mean, what we had the metric for what he had to do to allow fans to get excited by the end of the season. Now, I do think he's sat for games since then, and part of it was be in the lineup. Depending on how long Hoglander and Pettersson are out, he's going to take care of the being in the lineup thing for the rest of the season, you would think. And you're starting to see a little bit of the production as well, where I think you can be really legitimately optimistic and excited about what he can do for the team next season.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we also need to keep it into context, right? Like, I sort of think it's important to note that this club shouldn't be penciling him into the top six, no matter what we see between now and then. His usage should remain pretty low, I think, until we start to see him beginning to, like, drive and be more comfortable 5-on-5. I think there's a lot of work to do in terms of the hockey IQ as like an east-west player. I think his downhill attacking, I think his instincts are great. I think he's a pretty interesting puck carrier through the neutral zone. But I think if you're watching how he passes, how he contributes to the buildup, there's a lot of stuff being left on the table, a lot of deferring, a lot of not pressing his advantage, and then finding, like, creating space for a teammate to shoot. I think his playmaking's a little bit limited. And then the final thing is that next step, that last step that you have to take as a player his size, if you're going to play big minutes in the NHL, is the ability to win battles on the wall and protect pucks. Canucks have two of the best guys. Like, it's so easy to describe, because with Hoglander and Garland, you just say Hoglander and Garland and everyone knows exactly what you're talking about. There's going to need to be some core strength put on, I think, for him to demand the sort of role that clearly his shooting ability and just, like, raw talent, which is so exciting to watch and which this team is so desperate for, all of that leaps off the ice. But there's still a fairly large foundation for him to pick away at and work on before sort of he's going to be unleashed, I think, at the NHL level.
We will talk more about Lekkerimäki and his future and his role right now with the Canucks after the break. Harmon Dial from The Athletic joins the show. That's coming up here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance here. We're broadcasting live from the Kintech studio. Kintech Footwear and Orthotics, working together with you in step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. JanPro, from showrooms to stockrooms and everything in between. JanPro keeps workplaces tidy, clean, and disinfected. For a free quote, visit JanPro.ca. Now joining us, also covering the Canucks for The Athletic, he is Harmon Dial. Harmon, thanks for doing this, man. How are you?
Doing well, guys. How are you?
We're doing very well. So, I mean, we've been breaking down that game from last night all show long here. And, you know, we just had Batch on. We talked a lot of Quinn Hughes and just about the resiliency. But I want to start with you on Pugh Suter. Because, look, I mean, Pugh Suter has gotten a lot of recognition for what he's done for this team this year, obviously. Career high in goals. But that game last night where he steps up, not just into the top six, but to be the number one center, going up against a very, very good center in Nico Hischier, winning the matchup, scoring a goal, picking up an assist late, playing 23 minutes, you know, playing in overtime, doing everything for the team. That is a remarkable performance from Pugh Suter. And not that I'm just basing it off of one game, but when you see him be able to step up into such a significant role and at least in one game perform like that, you know, I know there's a lot of focus still on Brock Besser and will he be a Canuck beyond this year, but performances like that make me start to think, you know, Pugh Suter might be the bigger priority for Canucks management to take care of going into the summer.
Well, I'm not going to lie. There's part of me that is a little bit worried that he's starting to, like, if he continues finding success, sort of stepping up in this 1C role, that he'll start to maybe turn some heads and that his market price will start to inflate. Because the truth is, even before he stepped into being the de facto 1C, even when Pettersson and Hedl were in the lineup, Rick Tocchet turned to Suter to take on a lot of the tough defensive matchups ever since JT has been traded, to go head-to-head against top lines. And obviously the responsibility and role is escalated now that there's really no help around him down the middle. But he's been excelling in tough minutes for a while now, even going back to when I believe it was JT Miller had his leave of absence and Suter stepped up into a top six center role then pretty effectively. He's just been such a sturdy, reliable contributor. We know what he does on the penalty kill. And despite not having the loud physical traits in terms of the size and the speed that you typically associate with a shutdown sort of forward, he's just so smart. He anticipates, plays so well. There's usually at least once or twice in a game where the opposition is working the puck around the offensive zone. They attempt a pass into the slot, and Suter's there with the perfect stick lift to negate some of those passes into the slot. He's just effective in so many subtle ways, and now that he's been elevated up the lineup and is scoring, it's just becoming more obvious to the naked eye.
Yeah, and I guess part of the question, as you said, look, the more he scores and the more he plays this bigger role, the more people are going to be interested in him on the market if he gets there on July 1st. The other question is, you know, what role are you comfortable paying him to play for you, right? Does it need to be the type of salary where you're happy to have him on the third line? Can you afford to pay him as a no doubt about it top six player? How do you see that side of the equation? You know, like, do you only bring him back if he's going to be your third line center who needs to jump up in a pinch, or are you okay or comfortable at least taking the risk that, you know what, we're going to lock into this guy and he's going to be a fixture in our top six for the next few years?
Well, what I do really like about Suter is that even if he's not your third line center, he's also so good on the wing. Like,
yeah,
as a top six winger, as a complimentary guy, the results that he was putting up last season next to Miller and Besser, it's night and day how well that top line control play when Suter was on the wing with those guys compared to any other combination. And so that versatility is key, because even if you end up in a situation where you like your center options down the middle moving forward, which is probably a long shot anyway, considering how thin they are down the middle. But even if you get to the point where you say we're comfortable with how we look down the middle, Suter's so effective as a top six winger as well. Not to mention just how much he means from a defensive driver standpoint. At 5-on-5, on the PK, I just love him as this versatile top nine forward who can literally play anywhere in the lineup. And of course, you do have to be careful about, yeah, he's riding a slight shooting percentage heater. He's probably not a consistent 20-plus goal guy. But in having said that, I still think he's a super value Swiss Army knife type player. And I've looked at him as the type of player that the Canucks should be trying to make an effort to re-sign.
So the cap wages model, I've never used it before. I haven't seen it tested, not like the evolving hockey, not like the Twins model, which I actually trust. But they project him at 4x4, basically, for his next contract. So let's just use that as a non-scientific jumping off point to ask you point blank, General Manager Harmon Dial. Would you?
I'd seriously consider it. I know that sounds a little hefty, but I mean, prices are going up with how significantly the cap is rising. I mean, there was sticker shock for me seeing the Jacob Chychrun $9 million cap hit. And I know completely different player and circumstances, but given what Suter means to this team. And the thing, too, is a lot of times the logic behind passing up on, you know, if you look at a player like Suter in that type of situation and you say, well, that's too much for us, is the idea that you're trying to then find the next Pia Suter in free agency. But the problem is, I think that's a really difficult exercise as far as replacing everything he brings to the table in terms of PK, ability to play top six wing, ability to play middle six center, the secondary scoring. I think it's going to be really hard to replace his skill set at a bargain price. Even though four times sounds expensive, and while I'd prefer something like 3.5 times four, it's something I'd still consider doing. It's not like crazy to me.
Pew Suter ranks 95th in the NHL last 4 years, minimum 2,000 minutes played by goals per 60. Are we sure he can't be a consistent 20-goal scorer?
Maybe, but it... maybe. You know what? Maybe. Could be. I guess maybe not at this rate, right? Because he's got 21 and 70. So he's maybe not a consistent 25 goal, whatever pace he's scoring on this season. There's probably middle ground there where I do believe he's more than, like, he's been a consistent 14 to 15 goal guy. I think he's closer to a high team scorer, like a guy who can put up 17, 18, 19 goals. That's the type of range I sort of look at. And yeah, there's a possibility that if you bump his minutes up, he's closer to consistently being around that 20 goal mark. And really that's part of why, again, I'm a believer in his skill set and don't scoff at the idea of handing him a potentially decent sized extension.
Cost adjusted. Should he, like, are you willing to entertain the notion that he should be prioritized, like, even beyond or above Brock Besser?
That's interesting. I think with Brock, it's funny. For me, the number one thing I'd have to think about is, are you comfortable with, like, who's going to be his centerman next year? I know towards the end there, you know the five goals in three games that he just had without JT Miller, that's great. But Brock excels best typically with a centerman who can control play down low, off the hash marks, off the cycle, and can drive play and command attention so that Besser can then leverage his skill set of finding the soft ice in and around the slot. And I just don't know. Is he a perfect fit with Pettersson moving forward? They found chemistry late, but there have also been large chunks whenever they've gotten opportunities in small stints over the last 2-3 years where they haven't been as productive. And I'm not going to lie, I worry about the price of Besser's next contract, his ability to actually live up to it. I think he's a quality close to 30 goal scorer that you can rely on most seasons. But I'm not going to lie, I worry about Besser's ability to live up to his next contract, especially when you don't have a ton of high-end play-driving centers in your roster for him to potentially match up with. So, yeah, at this point, bang for buck-wise, I may look at Suter as as being more likely to provide positive value relative to his contract moving forward.
One more for you. Well, we'll ask you more than one more, but one more for me before I kick it back to Jamie here. I thought it was notable how aggressive Vancouver's defenders were against New Jersey. And we've now seen the Canucks, like, actually generate scoring chances in meaningful volume in two straight games. And I don't know that I've said that all season. So low bar, but I'm nonetheless at least wondering if this is the start of a trend here. Certainly the way that they sort of amped up the green light that their blue liners had to, like, we had Myers on the forecheck. We had Victor Mancini cutting through the mid slot and uncorking a wrist shot. We had Forbert setting up a goal from beneath the goal line. Like, it felt like in response to the forward absences, the Canucks cranked up the offensive involvement of their D, and it worked really nicely last night.
Yeah, I mean, I fully agree. That definitely stood out to me, especially especially the forward goal, or the goal that he, the pass he sent to Lekkomäki, the assist there. I was like, what's Derek Forbert doing below the goal line? But hey, this is kind of what they need as far as their defensemen being more involved, because it's not just the fact that their forward group is thin and they don't have as many drivers. You also get to a point where you need to generate scoring chances at a bulk, because you don't have a lot of threatening one-shot scorers in your lineup right now. Like a lot of the scoring chances that, for example, Quinn Hughes is setting up, sometimes they end up on like Nils Amon's stick or Teddy Bluger's stick, or Ratu had one or two looks. And those guys, you don't count on them to be high-end finishers, so you're required to generate chances at a pretty healthy rate, which, like you said, they've been able to do the last two games. I like Marcus Pettersson's involvement as well. That was a slick pass to Pia Suter, and he's a type of defender with his mobility, with his intelligence, and even looking at his time in Pittsburgh, his underlying metrics offensively, he can hang. He's not this pure shutdown guy that takes things away from the table offensively. I look at a guy like Marcus Pettersson and wonder if you give him more of a green light, even occasionally jump up in the rush, can he be can he drive a little bit more? And so absolutely, the way that their defenders were involved, were skating, it made their in-zone attack look a lot more dynamic. I feel like for most of this season, a big criticism has been that the Canucks still, they're dump and chase heavy, and when they do win pucks back on the forecheck, it's been a lot of low to high passes, D to D, static movement, the over-reliance on point shots. And what you'll notice is it's not just the D moving when they have the puck. When they move off the puck, it allows forwards opportunities to come high. And when you have multiple players moving both with and without the puck at the same time, it's a lot harder to defend against. The easiest thing when you're defending is when nobody's really moving outside of the guy who has the puck. It's easy to just protect the middle of the ice, but when there are exchanges happening, when you have forwards coming high, D moving down low, it opens up new lanes, new opportunities, and it's something that they're going to have to continue to do moving forward.
Jonathan Lekkomäki last night, Harm, scores in regulation and then gets the shootout winner as well. You know, you can see the offensive skill, the dangerous shot is all evident. Some of the growing pains in the areas that he needs to work on, also very evident. What does the kind of optimal path forward for Lekkomäki's development look like for you over the remainder of this season and then going into next year with the Canucks as well?
Yeah, I'd like to see him on the first unit power play. The brief moments that we've seen him on that last half wall, it just gives him another legitimate shooting threat that it feels like the penalty kills have to respect. I haven't liked the look of the power play lately, and that's another thing that when you look at the Canucks' path to trying to make their way back into a playoff spot, they're going to need the man advantage to get back on track at some point. The last six games, it's been clicking at around 15%. I didn't like the look of two defensemen on the top unit last night. So Lekkomäki on PP1, I think he has the intelligence. I think he has the puck skills, the shot, and the confidence and composure to make a legitimate impact there. Also, even on entries, that's an area where he is slick, creative, and poised on zone entries. And the first unit has largely struggled when they've lost faceoffs and have had to drive back up the ice and try and get set up. It hasn't been easy for them to make those plays under pressure to get their unit set up. So I'd like to see him on power play one. As far as him trying to continue the success that he showed last night, we know he has a high-end shot. The question has always been, how can he manufacture more opportunities with time and space to really let it rip? And to me, it was really encouraging that we started to see him read off of plays and find soft ice to get open. You look at the goal that he scored. He started sort of high in the play. Forbert had it down low, and he made the read to drive into the slot, which at points earlier during his NHL tenure, like, that's been an area where when the team's been cycling and building up chances, it sort of feels like he hasn't been able to get those open looks inside the slot. And I mean, that read was massive to get open and score in the third period. And then even the OT chance as well, when you watch that chance back, the way that he passes it to Quinn and immediately Lekkomäki cuts behind the defender to create the passing lane and then nearly ends the game in OT, it's encouraging to see him making those reads and feeling like it's more instinctual to know what spots of the ice to attack away from the puck, because we know that once he gets opportunities with time and space, he can let it rip. So I'd like to see him on PP1. And then from last night, I'd love to see him continuing to rely on his instincts to find more open ice in dangerous locations.
It's definitely not the biggest storyline from last night, Harmon, but I do want to ask you about Atu Ratu. And there's something about this guy, like, I can't quit thinking that he's going to pop at some point here for the Canucks. And I know the scoring hasn't been there in his NHL stints this year, but he is productive at the AHL level, you know, still only 22 years old. What did you think of Atu Ratu? And, you know, how much optimism do you have that he can be a regular player at some point down the line for this team?
Yeah, I mean, we know he's elite on faceoffs, and that's a huge leg up. When you're trying to be a bottom, when you're trying to develop into a bottom six forward, you've got to give the coach a reason, a clear identity that this is exactly what I bring to the table. I think sometimes what fringe NHL players struggle with is, sure, they can hang in an NHL environment, but they don't give a strong enough reason to demand a spot in the lineup. And I think how productive he is in the faceoff circle, especially for a team that struggles in the faceoff dot, is massive. And then from there, it's going to be about if he can just continue to work on his defensive chops or add some secondary scoring, add something beyond just the faceoffs, which I believe he can do. He's got a big body. I thought last night he wasn't particularly noticeable shift to shift, but he held his own. And to me, if he can, like, the question's always been the foot speed, right? I don't see a player in Ratu who is likely to consistently drive offense, or be much of a playmaker. But if he can, sort of like at training camp last season, it felt like there was a slight improvement in his foot speed. If we can see another slight improvement next season, can he become quick enough that he can find a role where he can, like, the one thing I like about Ratu is he's a bigger body that seems to, if you play him with a winger that can pass the puck well, he'll get a look here or there in the slot. And so there's enough skill from that standpoint. I do believe there's a good chance he can develop into a bottom six NHL player. I don't think he's going to have a high ceiling, but between the faceoffs, between the big body, between having, you know, decent IQ, if he can just find another level with the defensive side and with his foot speed, I think he'll be able to develop into a depth forward.
Harmon, appreciate the time, man. Thank you for doing this as always. We'll chat again soon.
Thanks, guys.
That is Harmon Dial covering the team for The Athletic. I don't know what it is about Atu Ratu, but it's just like every time I watch him, I'm like, there should be something there. There should be an NHL player
Safely, there's an NHL player there. I think the question is,
what is that? Like,
get to middle six upside?
Yeah.
Or are you looking at a fourth line center? Right? And I think that's a valid question. My gut take on it is I think he can be a middle six guy on the wing.
Okay.
I don't know if the speed will play at center. Like, you even notice it with Pugh Suter when he plays center for long enough.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
You do. Like, and he's a much stronger skater than Ratu. You notice it with Nils Amon, that his speed plays, even though there's a lot of stuff that he's not especially good at. You know, his speed is impactful over the course of a game. You notice it through the neutral zone constantly. Helps the team win, even though he can't win draws and he's, you know, doesn't have a lot offensively. It's like the speed still keeps him relatively effective. That's something that, you know, Ratu's never going to be able to provide that, I don't think. So I like him more on the wall because I think he wins a lot of battles. I think he's actually pretty talented in traffic, and I think he's a smart player. Maybe he's a winger who takes draws. I mean, that's okay.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, that's at least another thing in your toolkit as an NHL player, a situational thing.
Otherwise, I do think you are likely to cap out on him being like a real depth center, which is still a nice piece to have. But I'm pretty confident he's going to hit like 250 NHL games. It's just how high up the lineup and how effectively will he play in those minutes. You know, adding another step, as Harmon said, that would help a bit. But I still think you're talking about a guy who's like working toward an acceptable baseline. Right, as opposed to a guy who like could be fast
like
enough
adding
to be an impact,
adding another gear type of thing. Yeah. All right, we will take a break here. Send your text in 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. Some thoughts coming in about the Pew Suter potential extension, how they should be thinking about that cap space in general that we can get into. Anything else on your mind? Send it in 650-650, and we will be back for the last segment of Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Not sure about this one. House?
What does it remind you of?
Come on, man.
I don't know. What does it remind
Drance
you of?
Drance is going to get
it. There we go.
The what? Oh, yeah, I don't watch White Lotus.
You suck. You know what else it reminds me of? It reminds me of Donkey Kong Country.
Oh, I can see that.
On Super Nintendo?
Yeah, it reminds me of, like, the Simeon Segway or something from Donkey Kong Country. Super Nintendo, yes. Super Nintendo? That was the most Gen Z moment you've ever had in front of me.
I'm 33.
Yeah, I know. And clearly, Gen Z. You're like, Virtual Boy?
All right,
love Thomas. Donkey Kong, the Donkey Kong games, by the way.
I'm just saying. Super Nintendo?
Dom's upset now.
I know, he is. I'm sorry. That was
Dom's
just
quiet quitting for the rest of the show.
Yeah. I've been on your side all day. It's the taste of betrayal.
My bad.
It is Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. We're live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com.
Thomas used to be the trusted choice.
What?
Thomas used to be the trusted choice.
The trusted choice for what?
Yeah.
Hosts. Not anymore, bud.
That was your first mistake, Dom, putting your trust in Drance having your back. That was a big mistake.
Ooh.
Anyway, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We were having a good discussion with Harmon about the dynamics around Pew Suter as an unrestricted free agent, his career year, how that's setting himself up to get paid, but also just how valuable, how useful he is for the team. And, I mean, you threw out the number 4x4, and to me, that's a no-brainer.
No-brainer.
I'm rushing to do that contract. A guy that you have that can fill, you're totally comfortable playing him as your 3C. You like playing him on the wing in your top six, does so many different things with the salary cap going up. Like, it's hard. Here's the only argument I can make against it, and this applies to Pew Suter and even more so to Brock Besser, and is ultimately why I probably wouldn't be prioritizing signing Brock Besser that much, is we know they need to improve their forward group. It's easier to do that the more cap space you have. Not that you're going to necessarily do it in unrestricted free agency, but just the more weapons you have, the more available cap space you have, the more options you'll have to try to improve your forward group. So theoretically, every dollar you commit to somebody already on the team is a dollar that you can't use to go out and add somebody at the true top of the lineup who can move the needle. Now, that's true, but it also, well, if you don't bring back Pew Suter, yeah, maybe you'll go out and add the top of the lineup piece, but you're also going to be trying to replace Pew Suter. So to me, that's an argument against re-signing Brock Besser. Like, do you want to commit, you know, $8 million or $7+ million to a player when you know you need to go out and find difference makers on top of that? But once you're talking about $4 million, it's like, well, you're going to need to slot in middle six salary somewhere. Like that, whether you get the top of the lineup difference maker or not, you have a need for those types of players. And you know this guy fits really, really well here. Why not just go get it done rather than be, you know, left trying to find the next Pew Suter come July or come August?
Well, I also don't think the next Pew Suter is out there. Like, I don't. I don't think he's a player that you can find the next version of as easily. Well, not as easily. Like, I think it was a stunning example of evaluative inefficiency in the industry that Pew Suter had the opportunity to be Pew Suter in the first place. Like, you remember, man, I was pounding the table. I thought it was clear as day that he was the only other top six capable centerman on the market, you know, middle six capable centerman on the market that summer. And the Canucks got him in August. Like, those are the sorts of entire industry duffs on obviously good player opportunities that I just don't think really exist outside of, like, the Vegas expansion draft. You know, like,
well, and especially less and less with the flat cap going away.
100%.
Like, that was a huge part of it.
Right.
It's just how, like, teams tighten their belts and they don't have a lot of money to spend and guys fall through the cracks sometimes.
And when you do stumble into one of those opportunities, like when we've seen other teams stumble into those opportunities, oftentimes they prioritize keeping the guy. I'm thinking like Carter Verhaeghe in Florida. Mm-hmm. He's been there long term. I'm thinking, you know, for the most part, when those opportunities come about, teams keep the gold that they find. Four times four, I still think's a steal.
Dakota, like, Joshua is an example of that here. Totally. Right now, we know it hasn't worked out this year for obvious reasons, but
he's still a good player.
They were motivated to get that done, right? Rather than just, well, hey, maybe we'll find the next Dakota Joshua. They're like, no, we got him right here. Well, if the deal makes sense, let's do it.
Well, and I'd add that, like, I don't think the next Dakota Joshua did exist either. I think Dakota Joshua was another super unique opportunity because his development sort of fell through the cracks due to COVID, and like the taxi squad and the oddness of that season sort of brought him to group six maybe faster than he might have if his first two pro seasons hadn't been pandemic abbreviated, right? Maybe he has an American League playoff run for the Blues one of those years in a normal and goes nuke because he's got really good hands and tight and is perfect to score some big playoff goals and they know what they have, right? I mean, that to me, that's another totally unique one. I don't think there was, like, Yakov Trenin cost the Wild a massive haul, right? Like, players like Dakota Joshua went for way more than Joshua went for, and I can't see, like, a $1 million guy anywhere that did a Dakota Joshua-like guy, had a Dakota Joshua-like impact for any other team.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, I think those opportunities are going to become more rare, right? Not more frequent as the cap continues to go up. And on that point, Mike, the urologist from Brockville, Texan, do you guys agree with the concept with a rising cap, there may just be fewer players to hit the open market, so you should just re-sign your good players? And that could be an interesting dynamic here, right? I mean, we saw Jacob Chychrun today sign the big 8-year extension with the Capitals at $9 million, and there's maybe some sticker shock around the league at that. But with teams not really being in a cap crunch anymore, it's going to be very easy to justify re-signing your own players. And even in the flat cap world, teams love to re-sign their own players, right? Teams are way more comfortable re-signing their own players than they are acquiring a player who's on a deal signed with another team. You know what I mean? Like, they always prefer to sign their own players. And if you have the cap space, there's going to be a lot of that. So we're so used to the smart move almost always being like, hey, don't commit to this UFA, keep your powder dry, keep your cap space open, and see what opportunities arise. That still will make sense in a lot of situations, but you're also in a world now, I think, where you could be really, really diligent about carving out this massive chunk of cap space, and there might just not be that many options to use it on come free agency. And that's especially true if teams aren't looking to dump bad contracts as often, because that was always a big part of the open up cap space thing. It wasn't just so you can spend unrestricted free agency. It was so you could be the, hey, give us a second round pick and we'll take that deal off your hands. That's going to become less common now too.
100%. You are going to quickly get to a point where it's more difficult to spend your cap space than not. Now, not entirely. Like, I still think evaluative inefficiency is going to be a permanent feature of hockey because hockey's a sport that will fool you. Like, it's hard to evaluate and get things correct. There's so much variance involved. There's so much that goes into a down season and up season. Like, I still think there's going to be unique opportunities. And then there's teams that are going to fail and need to dump contracts. And,
yeah,
you know, the Brent Burns example to me is like one that looms really large, where it's like the Sharks were at the end of their window. They needed to start clearing out space. Carolina gets him for free. And in that situation, he's mostly been valuable. He's beginning to hit the age cliff this season. Like, you know, if a team like the Rangers misses the playoffs next year, again, because they're definitely going to miss it this year. Well, not definitely, but they're not looking great.
It's a good chance.
Like, they have a lot of deals. Like, one of those guys probably shakes loose, right? There's tons of situations like that. Tampa Bay, once they hit the sort of end of this run, they're going to have a lot of money locked up into, like, guys like Nick Paul, who's going to be, like, old.
Yeah.
And not have a ton of value, but like also be a guy who can probably help you win, right? And probably a guy you can acquire for free. So I don't think the fundamentals are going to entirely change. I just think it might be less direct, if that makes sense. You might have to like stretch a little bit further to monetize your cap space. The Chicago example is going to loom large in people's brains, where it's like this: they have gobs of cap space and almost too much of it to spend. But
well,
also,
I don't think there's any, almost any chance that Chicago could like spend all of its cap space for next year efficiently. You know what I mean?
Oh,
you
for
just,
sure.
You'd have to be, by definition, they'd be significantly overpaying for a lot of players.
Well, also, they haven't used their cap space efficiently yet.
No,
so
no.
Why would they start now?
No.
Right? I mean, the truth is that it's going to become tempting to like unique situation to point to unique situations where things have been mismanaged and be like, see? And the truth is that there's going to be teams that are operating, you know, like, oh, we couldn't extend Jake Guentzel and we couldn't extend Mikko Rantanen and we have all this cap space. And, you know, I'd imagine that the Carolina Hurricanes will put it to good use.
Yeah.
No matter how challenging it is.
Well, and as for much as we're talking about, hey, the cap's going up so much and, you know, does that make it easier to re-sign your own guys? Like, you do Besser and Suter and you're almost done.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
14 mil?
Like it does still force you to make some tough decisions, and that's why, again, Besser's such a bigger chunk of that. I don't know if you can foreclose your other opportunities and your other potential ways to add an impact player so significantly by signing Brock Besser.
Well, yeah,
that's the sticking point for me. Whereas with Pugh Suter, you still got a lot of wiggle room to go out and try to add another big piece.
Yeah, the problem is you need two big pieces and maybe more, right? I mean, this team's going to need a lot in terms of adding to their attack, without question. I mean, you might ultimately get to a point where you need to consider dealing from your surplus of defensemen.
It's true.
I'm serious.
Yeah.
Conversation. I don't think that conversation has been had in the Vancouver market since the days of Edler and Bourdon.
Yeah. Well, and the post 2011, like Ehrhoff, BX, now they didn't deal them, but it was unrestricted free agency, right? But it was like, oh, you're going to have to let one of them walk.
Yeah. And even then, I don't think they really believed that. They just, they wanted to keep both guys and would have figured out how to make it work.
Yeah.
You know, they just didn't ultimately have to. You know, that team added David Booth.
It's true.
Right? Like they had cap flex. So anyway, the rising cap and what it means, you know, we're seeing it as like football and NBA free agency play out, right? And you're definitely seeing some of that where like the New England Patriots couldn't convince guys to take their money. Like that was a big factor shaping the NFL offseason, for example. One of the biggest things you're seeing though is as cap space rises, as you get into a world where like 10 plus percent cap growth becomes the norm, which we've seen in the NFL anyway across the last 5-6 years. One thing that really does change is the big competitive advantage becomes less about how you acquire value in free agency, although that's still important, and more about how you time the signings of your own homegrown players, right? It's more about how you go early. Like there's a first mover advantage, not quite, but there's an advantage to being proactive, right? And being willing to effectively spend money early to lock in cost certainty on elite players. And that's why you're seeing, you know, the Eagles are the Super Bowl winner, but also the foremost example of this, where they got way out ahead of signing A.J. Brown and Devontae Smith. So Brown, A.J. Brown has a $30 million contract, and Devontae Smith has a, you know, a $25 million a year contract, where now you're seeing guys like Ja'Marr Chase right reset the market at like 40 plus Jefferson 40, like truly you're seeing just like 20% more, right? They got like a 20% discount over what, for example, a team like the Cowboys did by waiting and dragging their feet on CeeDee Lamb, or like the Bengals did dragging their feet on both Chase and T. Higgins by just being proactive about when they did it. And so I think more than anything, that's like key. Like one of the deals that earlier in this season was talked about as like a negative that I think is going to be a huge win for this club is the Nils Höglander extension. Like moving quickly on that, I think will pay real dividends in as the cap goes up, because, you know, let's be real. He's a really good player. The Dakota Joshua 3.25, we can say, oh, well, he hasn't quite delivered value on that, and we understand why this season, but man, that could be a home run contract. Even Heedle at 4.4, like, provided that he stays healthy and is just a good middle six center, doesn't have to blossom into a top six reliable guy, just like a good middle six center who can help you drive through the neutral zone, that could be a value. And in terms of what that means for the Canucks here, you know, like a player like Atu Ratu is up after the season, and this organization has, we know, sort of carved out this like predictable path that these guys take.
Yep.
Pod Colson they traded, but they did it with him last summer. Nils Höglander too. Archer Shelovs, Jack Rathbone, like they don't all work. Akito Hirose, but they 2 years. You get a 2-year show me contract basically as an RFA that we are heavily invested in, but like and believe in, and then we pay you beyond that, right? Like then we'll figure it out.
Then what you're looking for after that is the Nils Höglander deal.
Correct. Right?
That he's the guy who kind of graduated from that to the extension that kicks in next year.
But you would be even better off if you'd done Höglander for longer. You know what I mean? Like before that deal, right? At like $4 million and gotten an extra year of term on the deal. I wonder if you have to, like, I think there's going to be a real competitive advantage to identifying your, this is where I think the next frontier is. It's not going to be the efficiency and unrestricted free agency or that like Vegas Golden Knights thing. If the NFL is sort of an example for NHL teams to consider about what this looks like in as the flat cap goes up, it's going to be about being really efficient about projecting your own talent and moving quickly to lock them up at max term, at a larger size investment. Like, I think more than anything, it's going to be like bridge contracts should be rarer here. Teams should be pushing to get guys done long, early, and be willing to pay a short-term premium for it if they really believe in the player.
Well, and to have your internal evaluation and be confident in it enough that you're getting those right more often than not. You know what I mean? That's going to be a huge part of it as well. And the Canucks are going to have some interesting decisions, not this summer necessarily, although, as you mentioned, there's, you know, lower down guys like Atu Ratu, and there's actually a fair number of the Abbotsford players who we've seen make cameos at various points this year, RFAs, Sasson, Archdeep Baines as well. I think Linus Karlsson signed the 1-year deal, so he's no longer an RFA. But then you think also, and I think about the dynamic, and when I was on Halford and Brough last week, Rick Dhaliwal was on the show on Friday, and one of the things he said was it might not even be Villander's preference, if he does sign this year when his season is over, to immediately go to the NHL and burn a year of his entry-level deal, because what that does is kind of put you on this accelerated time frame to signing your next contract post-DLC, which sounds great in theory for the player, but one of the frequent knock-on effects of that is you haven't had enough time to like build up a case for a really strong statistical profile for a big deal. So there actually can be benefit to a team, right? Like if Philander came out this year, burns a year of his ELC, he'd be eligible for an extension next offseason with 1 year left on his deal, right? While on his ELC. And then, you know, like if you're the Canucks and you're really motivated to go long, you could potentially get a pretty interesting deal out of that. Now, if he wants to start this year in the AHL and then have the full 3 years, that changes the dynamic a little bit. But it's like Lekkomäki and Villander are the players that stand out to me, where how soon will it be before you're willing to kind of commit and take that risk?
Yeah.
You know, where you say, okay, let's go, let's think about what that long-term swing would look like and how much upside there could be to that. Now, they have to justify, they have to do enough on the ice where you're really thinking that. But those are the guys, like, on the horizon that the Canucks would theoretically have a chance to do what you're talking about with.
Yeah. So, Lekkerimäki, you've got 2 years, right?
Yep.
So, you're a ways out. You're a ways out on Lekkerimäki. And honestly, you're going to be a ways out
on Tom extension Belander. Eligible after next year.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah.
So you never know. Like, again, now,
yeah, that is a guy.
Both sides have to agree, and he has to be willing, obviously, to take some certainty, but leave some potential money on the table.
And you have to be willing to take on some risk because the numbers that you're probably, like, even if he just has, like, you know, let's say 80% of the Matthew Coronato season next year, right? And then you're moving quickly to sign him $5 million times 6 or whatever, you know, it's going to be like, what? We paid that for a 40 point guy. It's going to feel silly, but it's the right move, right? Like, that we're going to have to retrain our brains, I think, in terms of how we think about it. Volander, here's the truth, man. You're not playing PP1.
Nope.
You're never going to play PP1 on this team as it's constructed, right? I mean, even if Hughes were to depart, there's Filip Hronek, who's going to be here forever, right? So, and by the way, Tom Volander probably shouldn't play PP1 given his skill set, right? So you're not playing PP1, so points are going to be hard to come by.
Mm-hmm.
There's no world in which you're going to build up a good RFA.
You might not be playing with Quinn Hughes either. You're probably not, because that's Filip Hronek too.
You can take 3 years of runway or 2 years of runway. You're not going to be able, as a defender whose primary value is going to be defensive, you're never going to be able to build a case to win a home run second contract. Like, that very, very rarely happens, right? We used to talk about it in terms of Cale Makar and Miro Heiskanen and company, and look at all those deals. Like, 9.5 was, like, the record. Cale Makar, Quinn Hughes, and Miro Heiskanen broke second contract barriers set by Drew Doughty and Aaron Ekblad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, literally, the market hadn't been reset in a decade from the fundamental dynamic set by, like, the Pietrangelo Doughty Carlson class. It's hard to be monetized as a defender as an RFA. Like, if you're a defender, and Todd Diamond's a smart guy, he represents Alexander Barkov, so I worked with him long before I was reporting on the Canucks. But if you're a defender who doesn't put up counting stats, if you're not an offense first defender, all of your incentive needs to be, get me to UFA, baby. Get me to where I've got Matt Wall leverage.
Yeah,
that's what you're looking to do. So I would think probably do the probably they push to do the second deal, and the Canucks might push to be like, hey, you know who's rolling, the Abbotsford Canucks, you know where you can play 25 minutes every night down in Abbotsford.
Get some playoff experience.
Team's playing really well, by the way. Manny Malhotra.
Yeah, he's doing a great job. Four forwards from that group who have played regularly with Abbotsford has played a lot of games with all four of those dudes in the lineup.
Yeah, they all look great. They all contributed. Yep.
They all contributed.
Kudos.
So shout out to Manny Malhotra, man. First year down there with the Abbotsford Canucks. Pretty impressive.
Good coaching scouting in pivoting to replace Jeremy Colleton, right? Colleton, though, running a mean power play, so.
It would be nice. It would be nice to have.
Might have been nice to promote.
Promote
and,
from
and
within,
keep
yeah.
both, you know, because Malhotra looks like a real find for this organization.
Okay, we will wrap it up there. Thanks to everyone for texting in today. The roller coaster continues tomorrow for the Canucks as they remain in the New York area. They're taking on Bo Horvat and the Islanders tomorrow. So big Wednesday edition of the show. As always, we'll do the crossover with Donnie and Dolly, and we will have our guy Jason Bukala on as well to get you set up for the Canucks and Islanders. That's coming up tomorrow here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.